All right, guys, welcome back to Shakedown Shan. Hope you all have had a fabulous few weeks. We got dumped on by lots of snow this week. Was it this week or last week? I don't remember.
No, it was this Sunday to Monday because Monday school was canceled. And then yesterday we got another 3 to 4 inches.
Awesome. Time to move south.
Yeah.
But we come to you today with a very, very exciting episode. Today we have Dan Taxationist Theft Berman. Please tell me if I'm pronouncing your name wrong, Dan. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing pretty good. You got it exactly right. The middle name is that's the key to the whole thing.
Right. So Dan is a libertarian candidate for the 2020 presidential race. And I am very excited to have him on today and talk about his platform, his background, and what he has to offer to everybody. So why don't we just start off with just tell us a little bit about yourself, Dan.
Sure. So I grew up in Los Angeles, California, lived there for, I don't know, 20-something years, and then I moved to Texas. So I grew up in a blue state. Very kind of Democrat influences, and then I moved to Texas and kind of got the Republican influences. And from there, I just kind of, you know, I started getting into politics, seeing, you know, all these kind of injustices that were going around, mostly by the government. I started seeing people, you know, being killed, robbed, you know, assaulted in so many different ways by the government that I just started, you know, I wanted to come up with a way to fix some of these problems. And I looked at the Democrat Party, I looked at the Republicans from that background, and it didn't feel like either of them were trying to do anything about this. So I came across the Libertarian Party, and I think they had a more suitable platform for that. And so I've been running with those guys ever since. I ran for the Texas House of Representatives in 2014 in San Antonio and did really awesome in that election. We got 23%. We didn't win, but we did reach a lot of people. We did get a lot of people talking about, you know, some really important issues. So I see that campaign as a success, and now we're doing that at the national level.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, getting your message out there is like the most important. If you win, that's great, but I honestly think it's more about how many people you reach, how many minds you get to speak to.
Absolutely.
I actually have all of your platform stuff from your website in front of me here. In your background a little bit, it says you worked with Students for Liberty in Uganda and other African freedom-based initiatives. How was that?
Yes, so that was interesting. Maybe starting about a year ago, I started getting messages from people all over the world, and some of them I was like, okay, is this a scam? Are they, you know, one guy was asking me from Pakistan, he was asking me to send him books.
Oh, that's
and I
awesome.
Was like, I was trying to figure out if this was a scam. So I was like, can I just send you money? And, you know, let's cut to the chase. And he was like, no, I really want books. They're really hard to get here, especially liberty-type books. So I just started engaging in some of these conversations with people from around the world. And the guys in Uganda were actually, like, very, you know, very interested in talking to me. And, you know, we had lots of great conversations, and they invited me out to a Liberty Forum that they were doing, which involved a few other people that from different organizations that basically went out there, and they were having, you know, it was like a whole weekend of different people presenting different ideas. And it was just really awesome. So I got to go out there and see them in person, and they actually brought a lot of people from all over Africa, everywhere, Congo, you know, all the neighboring countries that were there. And it was just really awesome to see firsthand what actually goes on in those countries. And it was really interesting because, like, even though we consider those to be third world countries, like, you look at what those countries have and the problems they have and the political issues that they have, and they're really not that much different than what we have here. I mean, I remember when I was in high school, we would always talk about how, you know, the Japanese have these CD players that are like so much smaller than ours, and, like, you know, they fit in your pocket. And all this technology that we just didn't have access to. And it's like, you go to Africa and it's like, well, they don't have access to that either. And in, when we were talking about these CD players, it was like, we can't have these because they're not allowed to import them because of certain rules and regulations and everything. And you look at why the Africans don't have, you know, a lot of technology. It's mainly because of government restrictions and regulations. I mean, we're talking about 100% plus import tariffs on, you know, everything from cars to medical equipment and everything else. So you have government that's, you know, they're over there trying to get rich and trying to tax and, you know, say it's for the good of the people. And of course they bribe people with, you know, oh, well, elections are coming up. We'll come to your village and we'll give you food so that you can vote for us in the upcoming election. But then they're cheating these people out of every opportunity that they could possibly have by making imports more expensive and making goods and everything else extremely expensive.
Can I ask some questions? Dan, is that a part of the reason for that? Because they want to keep them under their thumb and not get into technology because that'll open up their eyes a little bit on what's going on around the world?
I don't think it's necessarily that's their intention. I mean, I think, you know, a lot of the government programs we have in the U.S. are done with good intentions and they just always completely backfire. I think you have leaders in a lot of African nations that are just very hard-headed. I know how to run things. This is how it's going to work. And then they try to create these policies. And, you know, the idea is that if you're wealthy enough to import a car, you're wealthy enough to pay 100% tax on it. But they don't realize that that makes everything more expensive for everybody else, because now the, you know, like you import a car and then maybe you use it for a few years. If it's not that expensive, you might buy another one, which means you're going to sell your old one and that's going to be sold for even less to somebody who couldn't afford a new import. So like it's all the downstream, I guess, trickle down that they don't realize that they're actually causing more harm. And, you know, a lot of these policies, like, I don't think they know all of the effects of everything. They're just kind of there like, well, you know what? I'm in charge of the country. I want to make some money. I'm going to charge taxes. And I need this money because I need to do what I want to do with my government.
Right. And it seems like they don't really want to know either. Like, they kind of just put it to the side, try not to look at it. Because, like you said, what they feel is right is what is right to them, no matter what the effects are. Which is the same, right. I would say, with our social programs and stuff here, too. Like you said, they're done with good intentions, but nobody really seems to care to look at the effects of these social programs.
Right. You know, one other thing, too, over here, it's like the Democrats for decades have been supposedly, in their minds, the champions of the African-Americans. But yet, when you look at where the African-Americans are now compared to 50 years ago, there's not much difference. I mean, they really don't do anything for them. And I think I think that's why today you start to see them moving a little bit away from the Democratic Party, because they're starting to realize, hey, they've been promising us things for decades. We're not getting anywhere any better. They never created jobs for us. And so I think there's a little exit away from the Democratic Party. I think they're starting to realize that finally.
Yeah, and I think my biggest issue with the Democrats and with the African-American community is that, you know, they usually lean on the Democrats as if, you know, these are the people who support us and you know, they're for the people, they're for us. But ultimately, the Democrats are usually the ones who are in bed with the police unions. And whenever you hear a story about, you know, an unarmed black teen gets gunned down by a police officer because he had his headphones in and he couldn't respond to instructions, that's the Democrats that are making sure those cops aren't getting fired. They're not facing any repercussions. Mm-hmm. They're not, you know, that's the Democrats. And they're also pushing for, you know, these gun laws, the gun restrictions that prevent people from being able to defend themselves. And they're putting people on dependency programs where, you know, they incentivize people to stay on welfare instead of giving them reasons to get off and go and make something better out of their lives. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and a lot of those are, you know, to a lot of people, good intentions. They want to help people who don't have certain things. They want to get guns off the streets to stop violence. They want to bolster the police to protect people. But ultimately, every single one of those plans backfires and creates more of the problem.
Yes, most definitely. So I, like I said, I have your platform all in front of me and everything. I know your biggest thing is the taxation of theft. I know that's your biggest message you want to get out there to people. And I really like how you break it down on your website. You break it down into two things about explaining how taxation is theft. You look at necessity and you look at morality. And the morality part is the most important, I think. And I think you broke it down really well. You say by its very definition, it is theft. If you don't pay, they'll take it. If you try to hide it, they'll arrest you. And if you resist, they will hurt you. I actually was just explaining this to somebody a few days ago. It's like if you walk up to a person on the street and say, I believe I'm entitled to the money in your pocket, they're going to look at you like you're crazy and tell you no, because that's their hard-earned money. Why are you entitled to it, right? And then if you're putting it in the analogy of the state, then that person that walked up to you and said that is then going to take out a gun or something to force you to give that to them. So like, it's like, if you wouldn't let some random civilian come up to do that to you, why are you gonna let the government do that? Why is it okay for them to do that? They should be held to the same standard we hold every single citizen of the United States. And then I also like your question, is it okay to steal to pay for a necessity? Or should we start looking for alternatives? I don't think that it's okay to steal for necessity. If you're starving, it's not okay to go into a store and steal food. You look for alternatives, going to food pantries, stuff like that. It's not okay to steal. And looking for alternatives is a great way to say, it's better to say start looking for alternatives than to just say end taxation. That way it gets people thinking, oh, maybe there are alternatives. So I really liked that language in there. Did you
have something? Right.
No, I know Shan's giving her platform, but I just want to ask you a question on some of the things that are going on today and get your opinion on them.
Sure.
One of the things that President Trump had just signed in is the food stamp reduction. I know social programs, I think, don't work because every year there's more and more money spent on them, but yet the benefits don't get any better for the people. It just creates more bureaucracy. But this food stamp program is very interesting because, and I keep picking on the Democrats only because sometimes they sound really stupid, you know. But they're saying that he's cutting food stamps back from elderly people and people with children and that. But when you get into the program, and I just want your opinion on this, see if I'm looking at it the wrong way. When I looked at the program that they've passed now, it's if you're young and you have children, you'll continue to get your food stamps. If you're disabled, you'll continue to get your full, you know, allotment of food stamps. If you're elderly, you will. But if your children are out of the house and you're between the ages, I think
18 to 49,
then you have to work 20 hours a week to continue to get your food stamps. Which, and I want to hear again, I want you to see if I'm thinking the right way. I think that's great because it's very easy to stay home and have the government give you money or give you programs. But if you're out in the field working, even if it's part-time, that gets you socializing among people. So after 20 hours, you may say, boy, you know what? I'm meeting people. I've got more advantages, and I'll get a full-time job.
I've got money in my pocket. Money's good. Maybe I want to work more.
So how is your how are your feelings on this?
I mean, I've known a lot of people who've lived in neighborhoods where there are lots of welfare programs and food stamps and everything else. And I think that's probably a misconception that, you know, first that people just stay home and collect that. It's like, they're still being social. You'd go bored out of your mind if you just stayed home and, you know, waited for food stamps to come in. But I think that is valuable. And what's really interesting is, New Hampshire actually did a similar program and it worked out really well. But the program was, it was basically, if you're able-bodied, so we're not talking about the disabled, we're not talking about the elderly. If you're able-bodied, you're able to work and you're receiving welfare benefits from the state, then you must conduct, you know, so many hours of community service. And what happened was we saw 80%, like within the first couple months, 80% of the recipients of those programs basically said, well, look, if I'm going to work, I'm going to go get a regular job where I get paid more than what this government assistance is. And what's really amazing is to that is it shows that, like, you know, the arguments about, you know, there aren't any jobs or, you know, it's the market, it's the economy, it's all these other things. Those proved to be absolutely false, because when these people were actually pushed to, you know, had an incentive to go out and get a job, they went out and got jobs. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't, you know, and nobody was hurt. It wasn't like people were stuck without, you know, without their you know, government programs to help them get by for a certain period. It was, you know, it worked out really good for everybody. So right. I think that's kind of a great first step. I don't know exactly how this new Trump program is going to work out, if it's the same or if it's going to be different. But it's, I think it might be a step in the right direction. We just need to make sure, you know, kind of like what Shan was saying about alternatives, is we just need to make sure that we're transitioning people into a better system rather than yanking the carpet out from under people.
Well, yes. I agree. And when I said that, you know, people stay home, and I didn't mean that. I think what I meant was people know that there's a safety net there and they're more comfortable in
right.
getting mm-hmm. money from that safety net rather than going out to get a job. And I think one of the president's views was that there's more jobs today than people to fill them. And I think, like you said, if they go out into the field to work and the socialization,
something.
And like you said, and Shannon said, they're making more money, and they'll say, if I get a full-time job, I'll have more money to spend, and you feel better about yourself that way.
You do. You really do.
So would that be one of your talking points when you're running, you know, in any
yeah.
debate? Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. And I even take things a little bit further, where I point out that, you know, government creates poverty and creates homelessness. You look at somebody who, you know, let's say your parents owned a house and they've passed. They leave the house to you. You pay taxes on it, everything else, but the house is all paid off. But now you have this house, and you might have to, you know, if you do have to pay taxes on it, well, either you have to come up with a lot of money or you have to sell the house and move into an apartment or a smaller house. And you have to continue to pay property taxes, which in some places, you know, your parents might have been paying $50 a month in property tax because they bought it so long ago. And when you receive it as an inheritance, well, now the property tax is reevaluated at the current market value, and it might go from $50 a month up to $500 or $1,000 a month. And so now it's basically as much as, you know, renting, you know, a small apartment in maybe a worse part of town. So government, with all of these taxes, basically says, you know, okay, you were set for life. You had a house that you could live in. All you had to worry about was your food expenses. But now you need to get out into the workplace and you need to get a job in order to pay for this. Now, I know a lot of people are, they're not going to sympathize with this type of person, because they're going to say, well, it's not fair. If I have to work, they should have to work too. But here's the reality of that. The more people that are entering the workplace, That means there's a surplus of labor. That means the cost of labor goes down. Everybody wants the cost of labor to go up, right? We're always talking about minimum wage increases and everything else. The reason those are as low as they are is because there are so many people fighting for these jobs. And they're basically saying, I need a job so bad, I'm willing to work less than this. But if you solve that problem by taking away all the taxes on life, they're basically life taxes, right? Because what are your basic necessities? Food, shelter, and when you're taxing shelter, you're basically taxing somebody's life. And so you're forcing more people into the workplace. Most of this money's going to government. A lot of that money's going from the government into politicians' pockets and their friends' pockets. And really, you just have a system where the government is creating more issues and it's creating more more poverty and more homelessness by kicking people out who were basically already set. I mean, if you think about it, there's let's say about 330 million people in this country. If there are 330 million houses, why are we taxing people and kicking them out of their houses and forcing them to get jobs when this country is already set? We already have that many shelters for that many people. All we really have to worry about is working hard enough to provide ourselves with food and maybe health care. But for some reason, there's this incentive that we have to keep working. We have to keep working. We have to get into the job market. We need 100% or 0% unemployment. And that's really how a slave plantation works, isn't it? They, mm-hmm. Like, always make sure everybody's working. Everybody's working. And so we need to get out of that mindset. And especially, like, a lot of people are talking about the automation that's going to replace a lot of our jobs. That's actually a wonderful thing. That means we don't have to work as hard, and we'll still have a better quality of life, because the cost of production of everything that makes our life great is going to go way down in cost.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. I don't think I've ever heard anyone explain it that way, mm-hmm. or I don't think I've ever thought of it that way either. Wow, that was actually very interesting.
No, I just, you know, I don't want to keep jumping in on top of Shan, but I think one of the things that you would project better than anybody else is we have to start aiming against unrealistic goals. I mean, just because something we had these goals for 150 years or 200 years, they don't work today. And we have to start thinking in different avenues. And I think a third party can do better than that, than the Democrat or Republican parties today, because you have to think outside the box, and they're so entrenched in their...
They're so stuck inside.
Right, inside their box that they can't think outside of it. And I think just a little bit of glimmer, and you may not like them, and you know, but I think a little bit of glimmer is this, is when you elect a non-politician and you can see a little bit of good that comes out of that. You know, the economy starts getting a little stronger because he's thinking outside the box. He's not entrenched in politics. So right. I think you would be in that category where you would be thinking outside of the box and bringing forth new ideas that would relate to today's world.
I think most people, I've said this a whole bunch of times, most people, by the way they lead their lives, go by a libertarian, like, way of life, morality. We don't want to hurt people, and we don't want to take their things. Most people, like non-violent people, not criminals, whatever, we lead our lives that way. And so why don't we hold our government to that standard too? I feel like when people start thinking about government, they give them passes on all these certain things. And just because they're the government, they're the state, they're powerful, they can do these things. But if it's really supposed to be for the people, by the people, we are the people as citizens, and so if our government is supposed to be by the people, they're the people too, so why shouldn't they be to the same standards that we hold us to?
Right. Yeah, and I mean, that's really the structure of how the government is set up. Like, you know, we the people, quote unquote, created the Constitution, which, you know, even though we didn't all physically sign it, we created the Constitution, which gives them power, and we don't have the authority to give them power. I don't have the authority to give you power that I don't have. I can't give you, Shan, I can't give you power to go out and rob somebody else on my behalf, because I don't have that right to do it myself. Mm-hmm. And so we have to understand that's the hierarchy of what that is. That one constitution is like, that's the foundation for all of the laws that are passed, and everything and all of the laws that are passed are the foundation for what the police and the presidents and everybody else are allowed to do. And I think that's really been lost in probably just in the miseducation of the role of government and, you know, how it operates and everything, which of course comes from government schooling. So, you know, it's, you know, they kind of control that narrative.
Mm-hmm. All right. Digging back into your platform here. So you say you want to fire the IRS, ending the illegal collection practices. Why don't you talk to us a little bit about how you might spin that in a debate or something?
So maybe 10 or 15 years ago, I started hearing people say there's no law that says most people need to pay income tax. And I was really intrigued by this because I kind of already had the feeling that taxation was theft at that point. But I didn't, you know, anybody I talked to about it, they were like, well, you just have to pay your taxes. That's just the way that things are. And so, like, I was in that bubble, and I was trying to find answers to, like, how is this possible? They're stealing from me. And so I started looking into, like, all kinds of, you know, objections that everybody has to why we shouldn't pay an income tax specifically. And it turns out that a lot of people have been fighting this for a long time, since the 70s. And it's so convoluted, the system that they've created, that it took me 10 years just to understand it. And that's based on based on not going through the code myself, which I did do, but from the understanding that other people who have gone through the code and who've been studying this for 30 years have been able to teach me so that I can finally understand it. And basically it boils down to this. They tried an income tax twice before, in the late 1800s. They tried two income taxes, and they were both struck down by the Supreme Court as unconstitutional. Then they passed the 16th Amendment, and then they created what we have now, the current income tax. Mm-hmm. And the way that they were able to get this by not saying that it's not constitutional, the 16th Amendment didn't change anything, and the federal courts agree with that. It gave Congress no new taxing power. What it did do is it asserted that the income tax is an excise tax, not a direct tax. And what that means is it's an excise on a privilege. Now, if you wanted to get a job working for the government, they don't have a right to give you that job. Or sorry, you don't have a right to that job, right? It's their own organization. They get to hire whoever they want, right? So if you go to the government and say, I want you to hire me, they can basically say, okay, well, we'll hire you, but you have to agree to these terms and conditions, how much you're going to get paid, how much tax you're going to pay, et cetera, et cetera. That's where you agree to pay taxes, because you're working for the government. But if I'm working for you or you're working for me, we have nothing to do with the government. So the government has no right to tax that transaction between us. And there's all kinds of Supreme Court rulings that support this. My property and my labor and my time are my property. My property is my right, and I have an inalienable right to contract my property to somebody else in exchange for money. That means it cannot be taxed. But so what they've done is they've created the system where the tax is legal because it applies to government employees. And then what they've done is they've redefined what the words employee means, and you can look this up in the tax code. And an employee is somebody who works for the government. So what they have done is they have created a system of constructive fraud that convinces every American that they have to pay this income tax. And they know this. A lot of people working for the IRS know this, and they actively push this this fraudulent narrative to get people to keep paying this tax that they don't have to pay. I know that's a big pill to swallow.
Yeah, yeah. Well, sitting here.
Well, you know, I mean, I'm a lot older than Shannon is, but I always followed Steve Ford, and he had a good plan. Eliminate the IRS, but it was still a tax that he promoted, and that was the flat tax. And the good thing about that I thought the good
percentage of the flat tax was. I'm going to use 17%. He's going to pay 17% of the total value of that yacht. And there's no deductions on that. I mean, he can't say, you know, bring it down to $2,000. So he's paying that flat tax on that yacht. Well, if I go out and I can't afford a yacht and I buy a canoe, I'm only paying the tax on that canoe. I'm not paying, you know, any predetermined amount. And if he goes out and buys prime rib, pays tax on that. If I go out and buy a hamburger, then I pay that tax on the cost of the hamburger. And I was always intrigued by that because he had proved that the government would take more money in by doing that way, and it would be less of a burden on people because you would only pay money on what you would, you know, the amount that you would use, and you could make as much money as you wanted, and you wouldn't have to declare any amount of money. It would only be taxed on purchases. Now, I don't know if that falls into your way of thinking, or, I mean, I don't think it could be as radical as saying, all right, we're going to eliminate the IRS by, you know, in 2 years. But I think some kind of tax structure like that would be beneficial to people, because if you didn't spend, you know, you wouldn't be accountable for your income. I mean, if you work under the table, it doesn't matter. You know, you're only going to get taxed on
right.
When you spend it. I don't know.
So there's a few different ways to look at that. So with the income tax, you know, it's a government regulation. It's a law. It's a force. It's a threat. And because of that, it creates a black market. So you have people who are, you know, they're working over the table and they're earning and they're paying the tax. But you also have people working under the table. That's the black market. And there's a whole lot of exchange of money going around and people not paying taxes. So when you think about a sales tax like that, in theory, yes, because you walk into, you know, a licensed yacht dealer or, you know, a Best Buy or a Walmart or anything else. And of course, it's a big organization and they're registered with the government and they're charging sales tax already. But what you don't see is that that's going to create a black market for a lot of people who are going to say, well, we have all these goods that we can sell less for the cost of the store because it doesn't have this. Because we're not charging the sales tax. And there's all kinds of ways around. And there's already people doing that now with their sales taxes and everything else. Now, what's really interesting about, so they have like a value-added tax, which, you know, it's kind of that same thing, and it eliminates that problem by taxing manufacturers. Of course, that still doesn't, family home-run businesses that are manufacturing, it, you know, doesn't necessarily tax them, but it creates taxes every step of the way. So it taxes your raw materials, it taxes into you know, some of the more developed products, and then it changes hands again, and it's taxed again. And ultimately what happens is you get a much higher cost of the actual goods that you're buying, and you don't even know how much is going to the government. So what's really important is to understand where all this money is going in the first place. And that's why it's really important to look at government spending, because Ron Paul said this, the real tax is the spending, because ultimately they're going to spend and spend and spend, and they're going to waste a lot on a lot of programs. They have, you know, their military budget is three times larger than China, which is the second largest military in the world, second to the United States. We have bases in 1,000 bases all around the world in just about every country. And a lot of this is waste. It's money that doesn't need to be spent. And then we're giving away money to research the sexual habits of quail on cocaine, like ridiculous programs. And if you eliminate that, then you eliminate the need for all the taxes, because ultimately, like, you know, you give them a blank check. Yeah, spend all this money. And this is, you know, this is the dynamic between Democrats and Republicans. Democrats are already always increasing taxes. Republicans are always lowering taxes. But what's the net effect? They both increase spending, which basically means, yeah, Republicans might cut tax a little bit, but when the Democrats get into office, they're going to say, well, look at this mess. We're spending so much money. We need to raise taxes. And it's always an excuse. Our national debt is always an excuse for raising taxes, because we have to take care of this. It's our debt. We're obligated. And so we have to stop the spending. That's one of the biggest issues we have to look at. Mm-hmm. And when we do that, we'll be able to cut back on a lot of taxes without having any issues, especially the income tax.
Speaking of the debt, another part of your platform on here is to erase the debt. So wondering if you could explain that one a little bit, because I know, like typical libertarians, you have things on here like end civil asset forfeiture and end the drug war, pardon the innocent. But I want to talk about a few of these really, really interesting ones that you had, like erasing the debt. I saw that and I thought that was pretty interesting.
Sure. So I was one of those guys that when I turned 18, I started getting all kinds of credit card offers in the mail. And I worked myself into a hole, and I had unmanageable debt, and I had to pay it off and deal with it, you know, the same way anybody else would. And I learned a lot about how credit works and why banks lend in the first place, of course, to make money. But I also learned a lot about how the Federal Reserve works and the entire monetary system that we have. So when I talk about erasing the debt, basically what it means is we can literally refuse to pay back debts and nothing is going to happen. And you can look at the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve basically prints money out of thin air. Well, supposedly they do, right? The United States Mint owns the printing presses. They own the plates for the money. They buy the ink. They buy the paper. They pay for the labor. They pay for the electricity to run the building. And somehow that's called borrowing from the Federal Reserve, who doesn't actually print the money. But, of course, they print the Federal Reserve's name on the money. If we were to eliminate, if we were to tell the Federal Reserve, hey, we're not going to pay back a dime because you never lent us anything of value, you never created anything of value to lend us, and this is all just a scam, they would literally disappear and there would be absolutely no impact on the economy or anything else. When we talk about a lot of the other debt that's owed, a lot of this is in bonds. And the way bonds work is really interesting. If I were to start a business and I were to sell bonds for that business, it would be illegal for me to sell them to you unless you signed a stack full of disclosures basically acknowledging that your purchasing of a bond is no guarantee that you're ever going to get the money back. But somehow when the U.S. government sells you a bond, it's a guarantee for life. There's no way they can ever default on it. There's no regulations forcing them to make you sign a disclosure. It's buy all these things. It's the safest investment your money can buy, which is a scam, because the government is already insolvent and these bonds are already, you know, if everybody took their bonds to the government and said, okay, well, I'm ready to cash in on these, they don't have any money to pay you. So they're already bankrupt.
Right. So and I mean, governments aren't permanent either. So if they were here today and gone tomorrow, that money is.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So the solution to this is, you know, we don't have to say we're not going to pay any of the bonds, but what we can do is we can figure out some sort of collective negotiation for that, which basically means, and you know, I've had this experience with people who have lent me money. If I owe you $10,000 and I say, hey, sorry, I'm absolutely bankrupt, I can give you $5,000 right now if you just erase the debt. And a lot of banks and institutions are happy to do that because they're willing to take $5,000 or they're willing to take half of what they're owed as opposed to the full amount, knowing that they're going to get it now and there's no chance they're ever going to get the full amount. Now, what's also really interesting about this is this hurts the credit rating for the United States. And people are probably going to hear that and say, well, that's a bad thing. Our credit rating is going to go down. No, that's actually a really good thing, because Congress has had this concept of a debt ceiling, and they've had this for I don't know how long, but the debt ceiling is meaningless because whenever they hit the debt ceiling, it's, uh-oh, we can't pass the budget unless we raise it, right? So they continuously raise the debt ceiling. But what does that really mean? They're calling up the banks and saying, hey, we need to borrow more money. Now, if you have a bad credit rating and you call up a bank and ask for more money, they're usually not going to give it to you. So this is actually a really good way to force Congress to live within their means, because it takes away their ability to raise that debt ceiling. And now the control of their debt ceiling is external instead of internal.
Wow, yeah, that's very interesting.
Yeah, and I think there's only one man that ever gives the good argument about the debt ceiling, and that's Rand Paul. Because his philosophy is cut
Or we can cut spending so many places.
Yep. We can. But the difficult thing is even if we cut all of the spending, which is, you know, pretty impossible, even if we did, there's still a $24-25 trillion debt that's there. And what's interesting about that number is if you collect all of the printed U.S. money in the entire world, you wouldn't be able to pay that $24 trillion debt. If you collected all of the known gold in the world, you wouldn't be able to pay that $24 trillion debt. That's like, that's how much that is. And so, like, are we going to keep increasing that until it's $100 trillion? And then what? Like, are we going to keep printing money and inflating and get into hyperinflation?
It's like we never have a limit. It's a never-ending credit card limit.
Right. Yeah, it doesn't make any sense.
No, not at all. Can you tell me what this legalized pineapple pizza is? Is this about is this about drugs?
it's a metaphor, yes.
Okay.
It's really interesting because I kind of picked up on that just because a lot of people were fighting over social media with it.
Mm-hmm.
I happen to love pineapple pizza or pineapple, like either Hawaiian or pineapple pepperoni, whatever. Pineapple's great. I love pineapple. But I saw people fighting over this, and it seemed to be like a fun little argument to get into.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was interesting. So I was like, you know what? I'm going to put that on my platform. Now, months later, the Prime Minister of Iceland actually made an announcement that he wants to ban pineapple pizza. And then a month after that, he made an announcement like, hey guys, that was just a joke. And I don't know, like, there's some discussion about whether it was an actual joke or whether it backfired on him, so he had to, you know, retract his statement. But there was that. And then months after that, the Department of Homeland Security released a document, and you can actually go get this document. It's on legalizedpineapplepizza.org, and there's a link where you can download this document from the Department of Homeland Security's own website that basically says there's a fear that Russians are infiltrating our social media, and they're getting us – they're sabotaging us by forcing us to argue over insane little things like whether or not pineapple belongs on pizza.
Oh my God.
So yeah, so it's if anything, that kind of shows that I'm ahead of the curve, and I'm ahead of international intelligence as far as
so you fear they're gonna ban pineapple pizza, so you gotta be ready for that. Okay, I get it now.
Exactly. But then as the metaphor for the drug war, it literally is, nobody has the right to tell you what you can or can't put into your own body. And I may not agree with what you put on your pizza, but I will defend to the death your right to eat it. It's your body. It's your choice. You get to eat whatever you want. And if that is if you want to put magic mushrooms on your pizza or cannabis or whatever it is, that's your choice. And if it's bad for you, if it's unhealthy, like a lot of people say cheese is unhealthy or sugars or carbs or all the things that are in a pizza. If you eat pizza every day, three times a day, you're probably going to be pretty unhealthy. That's your choice. And so these aren't – like, we shouldn't have government coming in telling us you can't have cannabis, and we shouldn't have government coming in and telling us you can't eat too much pizza, because it's going to turn into, like, what, people getting shot and arrested over pizza? Like, it's insane to think about, but that's literally what's happening with this harmless plant.
Wasn't there an idea for a soda tax, or did they actually do that or something?
Yes.
New York City did.
Seattle also.
Seattle too. Yeah, so it's kind of like that.
And what's funny about like in Seattle, they created a black market. They were, I remember seeing Gatorades, because they have sugar. It's considered a sugary drink. They were, like, the price went way up. And so, but that was only the city of Seattle. So people were buying, like, cases of Gatorade from outside of Seattle, trucking them 10 minutes and selling them at, you know, half the price. And they created a black market on Gatorade over a sugar tax. That's, like, insane if you think about it.
We should have just dumped it all in the harbor.
Well, you know, you're right. when you realize, when you know the background of Gatorade and why it was invented, was because football players had it taken in during football games. I mean, that's why they called it Gatorade, the University of Florida.
The Gators?
Mayor of New York City, he wanted to ban all 16 ounce soda.
Right. Thing.
So you buy 2 8-ounces. I mean, it was such a phony thing. I mean, but
right.
Just another way to make the tax. When you stop to think about it, I mean, soda bottles come in 16 ounces, so it's easier to grab one 16-ounce bottle than 2 8-ounce bottles. You know what I mean?
Right. And it backfires because now everybody who was buying 16 ounces is buying 2 8-ounces. Well, they're creating more pollution. So a government solution to your health just created an environmental problem or worsened an environmental problem.
And now he's running for president.
Right.
So speaking of running for president, I wanted to get your insight on why you should be considered more than anybody else that's running in the LP race, or maybe why, I don't know. I want to get your insight on who's running for LP and why you think you're the best choice.
Sure. So one thing I would say is that there are a lot of great candidates, and when I win the nomination, I would love to have a few of them on my campaign team because they
right.
They really
I know it's like
awesome
a really hard choice. There are so many of you that are so great.
Yeah, and you know I've been through this with the Libertarian Party before, and I always thought it sucks that like you know in Texas we had I think 3 or 4 different candidates running for governor in 2018, and I was like I can't choose between them. Why can't they run as a team? So you know that's one of the things that I really want to do. As far as what sets me apart from them, I think is that, you know, while they all have very strong libertarian messages, what I've been focusing on with this campaign is figuring out, you know, because, we can get a bunch of libertarians to vote, but what's that going to do for us? That's mm-hmm. like, you know, they talk about 40% of eligible voters don't vote, and if we can get those 40%, we might be able to win, but that's very unlikely because those people just don't like politics. It's
right.
not like they're libertarians like that we need to activate. What we need to do is we need to get Democrat and Republican voters, and we need to figure out how do we, you know, because like you said, like pretty much everybody is already a libertarian when it comes down to, you know, practically how they live their life. We just need to figure out how do we communicate to them that they understand this. Like I talk to a lot of Democrats and they're like, oh, you want to get rid of taxes so everybody can starve in the streets. And it's like, no, that's not it. So I've created a healthcare plan that a lot of Democrats and you know the Bernie Sanders supporters are very attracted to, because it doesn't just say, well, we're going to get rid of taxes and that's the end of it. It basically says, look, these are the reasons your healthcare is so expensive, and this is how we're going to use a libertarian system, a non-aggression system that doesn't tax people, doesn't steal from people, to make sure that you have access to all the healthcare you could ever want or need at a very low price, less than what you're paying, less than what you would pay for medical insurance under Bernie Sanders' plan. And I think that's really important because, like, out of those 40% of non-voters, if we were maybe to get 10 or 20 or even half of those, that's not going to do us much good. We really need to get, you know, 10, 20, 30% of the Democrats and Republicans to understand that libertarianism is better for them than the current parties that they've been supporting.
Mm-hmm.
If you say, all right, you know what I mean? Am I making any sense or am I just kind of...
Yeah. No, I think you're absolutely right. And, you know, the Libertarian Party has been doing that and they have been growing over time. And it is a gradual process. Like, I a lot of people bring up the issue of, you know, are you in this race to win or are you in this race to educate? And I look at that like, you know, okay, well, you're taking a road trip. Are you in the road trip to get to the destination or are you in the road trip to put gas in the car? You still got to put gas in the car, even if your goal is to get where you're going.
Right.
And
because
you know,
if you don't, you're not going to get there.
Exactly. And so we're not going to win any libertarian presidency just by saying we're the best candidate. We have to change the political conversation that people are having.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's really, really important. And we have to understand why they're having the conversation that they are having. And it is mostly it's fear and it's control. And once we understand that, then we can address those fears and we can offer better solutions that don't excite those fears, but calm those fears and say, look, there's a better solution to this that doesn't involve some, you know, grand new government program.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we get people really interested.
And I also think that by
Yeah, I think it's a good time for third parties to start getting word out there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think we saw that especially in the last election, you know, just because it is so divided and, most people are voting for the lesser of two evils. They're not really voting for anyone. And I think, you know, that alone is a huge sign that, okay, give them an even lesser evil, and they'll be able to say, okay, I can support that.
Right. Isn't that a sad thing? It is.
Yeah. Vote for the lesser of two evils? Yeah.
That's why I think that there's not a lot of people voting. It's because they don't vote for it. So people just don't go out and vote.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's inherent in the system, too, because you have, you know, who in their right mind would run for president, especially within these big Democrat and Republican parties where they have such a high bar for even making it into their primary. Like, you know, like it's almost always some insider. Trump kind of broke that, but you can't look at him and say he's not power hungry. He's a powerful person. He likes having power. And he's had that throughout his business. And that's why he got where he is. And government is a tool of power. So, of course, it attracts people who want that power, and they want power to come in and change things the way that they see fit. And I think once we give people a realistic solution to say, look, I don't want to tell you how to run your life. I just want to show you that there are better ways to run your life that both of these parties are not going to give you, and they're going to try to take that option away from you, then I think that's where we really get people interested in saying, okay, this guy, you know, just like a lot of people said about Trump, he's not a politician, he's an outsider.
Right,
To that circle, you kind of, but he's still power hungry. And I think that's something that differentiates me from him. Right. I might.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, absolutely. We're actually working on our convention schedule right now. The convention season starts in January, so we're going to be all over the country. And we should be publishing a schedule of that pretty soon. But yeah, we'd absolutely like to have, you know, more events and go out and meet a lot more people and you know, recruit more volunteers and get the donations and everything. Because, I mean, one of the really efficient things that we're doing right now with the money that we are bringing in is, you know, we're being censored by Google and Facebook and all these social media platforms for being third party, but they're still corporations and they still want money. So what's actually really great is we can run paid ads, and they're very inexpensive, and they really help to get the word out. So you know, this has been a really great way. We've reached over a million people already with this message. And, you know, we're going to keep going. We're, you know, we haven't even hit the primary yet.
Yeah.
So,
no.
We're just like, that's the thing. Like, we need to figure out how do we reach the most number of people with the fewest number of dollars, until we can, you know, shake things up enough to get into to break into that mainstream conversation. And, you know, once we do that, which is most likely going to happen after we get the nomination in May. You know, that's when they're, you know, because right now we're just a bunch of crazy libertarians trying to get a third party nomination. So we'll be taken a little bit more seriously once we have that.
Yeah. As far as volunteers go and stuff, Saratoga is a big college town. We have Skidmore here. And so you might be able to find some people up this way too. When you're in New York in this area.
Yeah, that'd be great. Let's talk about that after the show and let's see what we can organize.
Yeah, of course. Well, I got to cut it short here. We'll definitely be in contact, but thank you so much for coming in on my show. I think what you and the Libertarian Party are doing for this presidential race and just in general is always really great. I'm very excited to see what goes on for this election, and I'm very happy to have the chance to talk to you. So thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you.
All right. You have a great day, and I hope all my listeners have a great weekend as well. Don't get snowed on too much.
Take care, Dan. All right. Have a good one.
You too. Bye.